I stopped by a payphone to call my wife, which was like 3 o'clock in the morning here. And I said, you won't believe it. I've just had this massive scoop, biggest story that's going to happen in my career, I reckon. Maradona kicked out the World Cup, drugs, you know, no, no, no. And she said, what, you rang me at 3 in the morning to tell me that? You know, put the phone down. So it put me back in my box, you know.
Hello and welcome to Outlines, a podcast about sport, stories and the media. My name's Owen Connolly. Hope you're well. It is great to have you listening. The name of the Haters news agency is venerated within UK sports media. Founded by Reg Hayter all the way back in 1955, it made its reputation not only in the quality of coverage it provided to national and regional newspapers, but also in the extraordinary list of journalistic careers it's launched, from Steve Ryder, Martin Samuel and Henry Winter, to Peter Drury and David Ornstein, and plenty more besides. Our guest this time, Jerry Cox, also cut his teeth there. And today, he's the co-owner and managing director of the Modern Day Operation, having been with Haters on and off for somewhere around half of its 7-decade existence. In recent years, he's put much of his energy into adapting the Haters business for our current media era, still dealing in the currency of sports news, still bringing talented young reporters into the industry, but now also generating digital-first stories and content and communicating directly with audiences of football fans. As well as supporting other news organisations, Haters now has its own substantial following, particularly on YouTube and social media, and I spoke to Jerry about balancing those demands, blending strong journalistic principles with the algorithmically sensitive best practices of 2025, his thoughts on the current state of sports media, and his hopes for a World Cup in North America that will bring him back to the site of a couple of his own great scoops. That and much more to come. If you're enjoying the podcast, then please do subscribe, rate and review, and spread the good word. Get in touch too. The social media details are in the show notes. And look, if sports media is your thing, then this is a really interesting conversation. Here is Jerry Cox. So how's this summer been for you guys? You obviously break up from the week-to-week press conferences and fixtures and all the rest of it, but there's been a few things going on.
Yeah, well, it's good and bad, Owen. normally, if you've got a men's World Cup or a men's Euros, we know it's going to be busy. There's huge interest, particularly around England. And there's the build-up to the tournament with a couple of friendlies. And then there's the first match press conferences and training sessions, all of that, that performs really well for us. And then you're into the tournament. And, you know, if England go all the way, obviously we get great, great interest in that, both on our sort of B2B clients list and also our own B2C sort of channels. You know, YouTube is huge for us now. So that's a big revenue source. And, you know, that performs really well. This year has been really different because we were expecting and hoping we were going to get quite a lot from the Club World Cup with two leading English teams in it, Chelsea and Man City. And we also had the Women's Euros, which were a bit of an unknown quantity, but we've been working hard to keep our women's coverage sort of growing, and we've got some good people gone out there to Switzerland. So what transformed was that FIFA have really been difficult at the Club World Cup, you know, having promised us really good access well in advance of the tournament. It became apparent about a week out, when we'd already committed to sending at least one person, our Chelsea guy had already paid his fare and accommodation, that although we could film almost everything, we could only use 30-second bites here and there.
Right.
You know, which were pretty use and couldn't use on social media, couldn't supply to other clients. So, I mean, almost a complete waste of time. We got some written coverage from it. We got some tiny, tiny sort of video elements from it, but it was pretty disastrous. And I mean, you may well be speaking to other people from the industry, but all the other international sort of video journalism agencies feel exactly the same. You know, it's been a real mess, and not helped by FIFA and DAZN being utterly disorganized in the build up to it and changing the goalposts during the tournament. You know, it's been an absolute mess. And it's, in fact, I've been on a call this morning just as a sort of debriefing, and we'll have another one in the next week with the other major agencies and international media, because the concern would be if it's anything like this bad at the World Cup next year, then we're all in trouble. So that's been an utter disaster this year. We were expecting to make something out of it, and I think we probably hit a loss on one of our guys. We called off before he even got there, the Man City correspondent, but the right. Chelsea guy was already there. And even though they went all the way and won the thing, we've got very little out of it. So it's been disastrous.
Ah, tell us what you really think.
Well, if you read The Athletic, they'll tell you what. Yeah. But on the upside, the Women's Euros has been really, really good for us, especially as we're, you know, in the last 6 months to a year, we've rebooted our women's coverage. We were, in fact, one of the first broadcasters of women's football in the UK back in 2004-5. We were doing the very early days of women's football, organised women's football, on behalf of the FA. We had a contract with the FA.com. We'd go along to games, film the match, do an interview with a coach or player afterwards, and then create a sort of short 3 to 5 minute painted edit. And that was then distributed to the FA, who would pass it on to the BBC. And I think The Guardian were probably the only other people interested in that at the time. So we've got a strong track record in women's football. And although we've tried to sort of reboot over the years, you know, we've found, as everyone will tell you, a lot of the sort of traditional media have been fairly resistant or not particularly interested in buying, spending money buying coverage. They'll sort of, you know, there's been a sort of a nod, an acceptance that we should cover women's football, but they don't really want to buy in content. So it's been a bit of an uphill battle, but we've got some really good people on board now. Aisha Galati came on board towards September time last year, and she's really driven it forwards. And she's out there in Switzerland with another young woman, Jamie Spanger, and they've been doing a daily show, and the numbers have just been picking up and up. And actually, we were doing a daily show, a live show on YouTube, from the men's Euros last year, which was studio-based, but had one or two of us, the guys who were out in Germany, doing sort of reports back, lives into the studio, and updates with conference coverage and mixed zone interviews and press conferences. And the numbers, and Aisha and Jamie are doing a similar thing now from Switzerland, but the numbers are at least double what we were getting for the men's show. So it's growing, and also you can see the interest growing as the tournament goes on. You know, we found this in 22 when England won the women's Euros then. The interest grows as the tournament develops. You know, we predicted that then, and it's happening again now. So that's good.
Yeah.
And then what was quite interesting was Arsenal's pre-season tour just kicked off this week, and we did our first Arteta press conference. And we do have a big Arsenal following on YouTube particularly. And, I mean, that did something like 250,000 views in a day, and all the comments were, "Haters TV is back," and we had to keep saying, "We haven't gone away. You just haven't noticed." I mean, we're posting, you know, compilations, documentary type stuff, transfer rumor roundups, interviews with ex players, all sorts of stuff.
Yeah,
but for those hardcore fans, what they want to see is from the horse's mouth, you know, what Mikel Arteta's got to say. So that now will sort of should be the lead in to the start of the season. You know, there are a few more tours. We're out with Spurs in the Far East as well, Spurs and Newcastle in Korea and Hong Kong. And then there are a few friendlies at home, you know, some high profile European clubs coming over to Chelsea, Tottenham, United and so on. So we'll have some good coverage in the build up to the season. And as you say, once the season starts, it's pretty full on, and it sort of looks after itself in terms of just getting that. It's all non-rights stuff that we cover, you know, men's, mostly in men's football, now increasingly in women's, but it's the press conferences pre and post, mixed zone access to players in European competition, which is fantastic, training ground access to teams in European competitions. And then, you know, we're hoping to do more on the sort of live shows, studio discussions and things like that. We're just in conversations with a couple of sort of brands about sponsoring a sort of high-end weekly discussion show, maybe fortnightly, but, you know, that sort of thing.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, that's a really interesting picture and where you guys are and where a kind of video news agency would be in 2025. You know, I mean, before we get too far along with that, let's take a step back, because Haters is kind of, it's one of those names, it's a bit of an if you know, you know, in sports media because of its heritage and some of the reporters who've been involved with it on their way up into nationals and other parts of the sports media in the UK. But how would you introduce Haters in 2025? What would your definition of it be right now?
Well, it's we always try and do it in two ways. One is to say we are a sports, you know, we're a cutting edge sports digital content agency, particularly in football, strong in football. But we also stress our heritage. You know, we're 70 years old this year. And like you say, hundreds of journalists, producers, broadcasters, editors have come through, you know, the Haters ranks. Often it's a starting point for a lot of people. It was for me for hundreds. And, you know, there's a diverse name. We had our sort of 70th anniversary sort of event in February. And, you know, you've got people like Gary Newborn, head of sport at ITV for many, many years. And now Mark DeMuth, who's head of sport at ITV, who, you know, I sat between him and Des Kelly when I started out, having just replaced Peter Drury, you know, the well-known commentator. Now, the sort of young people that we gave opportunities to, since I've been there pretty much on and off sort of 35 years, really. So pretty much half of the Haters story I've been around, freelancing before and then had a couple of years away and then came back. But, you know, some of these young people that we gave the opportunity, we gave them the break, have done quite well for themselves. You know, David Ornstein's done all right. And he always, you know, when he picks up his awards at the SJAs, he always remembers to sort of thank Haters for giving him a break. A lot of the young people in digital storytelling, if you like, whatever you want to call it now, but journalism, you know, in different formats, have gone on and had good careers. So our position as an agency that we've obviously moved with the times, we've had to, you know, we've had to evolve to keep ahead of the curve consistently. So, you know, going into TV in around 2000, we were the first non-broadcaster to start pitching up at press conferences with a camera and go on tour with teams with a camera, you know. So we were in the very early days of that. We were certainly in the start of sort of digital publishing. You know, our clients were people like The Sun Online, The Mail Online. You know, we were providing the bulk of their video content back in the mid-2000s. And then working with bigger groups, you know, I personally set up the whole news gathering operation for what is now Stats Perform back in 2011-12, because I had good relationships with a lot of the clubs. And we were the sort of us and PLP and Sky, obviously, were the two sort of us and PLP were the two sort of agencies coming in to have a sort of global, you know, coverage of every sort of Premier League pre and post match. So, you know, we've always been at the cutting edge of that. And then around 2018, we started to take YouTube seriously, because previously it had been a sort of repository for our content. You know, we used to have it as a shop window for people to see, this is the sort of stuff we do. But when we started to see that there was an income potential and it was growing, we then got into bed with an agency which helped to sort of accelerate the growth. But fairly quickly, especially around the 2018 World Cup in Russia, we really it really took off. And actually, we've sort of been doing it ourselves since then. No commission paid out, which is handy. But we have a good relationship with Google. We have a sort of client manager there who helps us with advice and so on. But we've worked, you know, pretty hard to refine our processes, and we're constantly updating it.
Yeah.
And so in parallel with that, the sort of people we bring on board, you know, we do get bombarded with applications for sort of work experience or jobs. And now the people we're bringing on board are the people that we think are going to work well for the digital age. So Whereas 20 years ago, primarily they would be written journalists. You know, 15 or 10 years ago, we'd want someone who was at least open to the idea of using a camera, you know, fairly basic, not high-end, sophisticated stuff, but sort of, you know, get the basics of focus, lighting, you know, audio, get them right and be able to do a simple edit to transmit the content. And now we're moving much more towards digital natives, short form storytellers, you know, the Instagram, TikTok, Snapchat generation.
Yeah.
Because that's, although there's still, you know, it's questionable how much income there is in that right now, that's clearly what people are looking for. You know, we had a conversation the other day as a sort of debrief for the Club World Cup internally, but looking ahead to the World Cup, thinking we can't assume we will turn up at the World Cup as we did, say, in Qatar or even before, assuming there will be traditional work in the traditional media for us as a freelance agency, or even to be able to get much content in the sort of YouTube style long form widescreen content that we, you know, make most of our money with now. That will be difficult. But what brands will be interested in is having a team of influencers and young digital natives on the ground, whether they're interacting with fans, doing stuff outside the stadium, being able to go to those sponsor-led events. You know, I've been to World Cup since America in 94. And you know there's always going to be ambassadors put up by the brands, the sponsors, and so on. You know, they're almost daily events outside the stadium, outside the circus ring, circus tent, if you like. And is it now, do we need, you know, young TikTokers, Instagrammers who are going to be able to do that content as well as the traditional capture? So that's, you know, that's our thinking, and that's how it's evolved and continues to evolve.
Yeah, I mean, it's been quite striking in the last couple of seasons where we've seen more of that stuff coming from press conferences that's had the Haters brand on it, and that brand's been more and more prominent. You know, you talk about Instagram. I think I had a nose at your page the other day, and I think that's up into the kind of high hundreds of thousands now of audience there. And for an agency that's typically been sort of at one remove and white labeling stuff and all the rest of it, that feels like a conscious decision to be a little bit more visible on your own terms in the last couple of years.
So we took a conscious decision to try and put the Haters brand out there pretty much just after lockdown, because that was a very challenging time, you know, existential sort of crisis for us, not being able to sort of gather any content and not being able to take a cameras back into stadiums for probably a year after lockdown, really. So the two things we discovered were, A, we could really still create a lot of content for our YouTube audience that wasn't to the high standards of TV that we were used to shooting to, because Zooms were still quite acceptable. Also, we found more creative ways of storytelling, putting compilations together. You know, we did a documentary about a year in the life of Liverpool from losing the Champions League final right through to winning the Premier League title, winning the Champions League and winning the Premier League. Because we'd been at pretty much all the games, all the events, we got some nice colour. So we decided to be a bit more, you know, creative like that. And we also wanted to put the Haters name first and foremost, you know, go properly B2C. And what we did there was we created these, you know, the little mic flags, and just said to the guys, you know, the reporters, look, if you can put it on the front desk and put it under the manager or the player's nose when they're doing an interview, just like Sky and TalkSport and others, do that. And it's sort of, you know, it's recognized around the world now. You know, I was at SoccerX in the States, and the guy from CBS Galazzo, the exec producer, I had a microphone in my hand as I went to sort of just introduce myself, because I'd just been interviewing Bruce Grobbelaar, I think, or something like that. And he went, oh, you're the Haters guy. We love your stuff, you know? So it's sort of working like that. And, you know, it's quite a deliberate act. And there are obviously many, you know, you can't put that microphone up in front of on a UEFA event or a FIFA event. And some clubs are a bit touchy about it. But, you know, we're not trying to do anything that others don't do. And it's good branding, and people like, you know, it's a bit of variation. People like the logo. And we've noticed one or two mainstream publishers, when they rebooted their digital offering, did a very similar thing with exactly the same color and and sort of style of video journalist. So yeah, that was a deliberate thing, and it's been pretty successful, really.
Yeah, and where are you seeing the most growth from that newer audience, that B2C audience? What, both in terms of where people are watching and in terms of the type of stuff that they're engaging with?
Well, I mean, what's fascinating is, I mean, you mentioned it's over 250,000 followers on Instagram. I think we're over 800,000 on YouTube subscribers. And if you add all our offerings together, followers and subscribers, we're nudging 2 million now. So there's a chunky audience, you know, which is quite a nice thing to be able to go to brands with and say, you know, listen, we internally, just with Haters channels, we've got a huge core audience, 2 million or so. We get something like somewhere between 20 and 30 million video views a month across long and short form content. So, you know, even if it's a brand who wants to get some awareness, you know, we can give them that. But then additionally, we've obviously got a distribution chain because we've got clients, and some of them are global, other agencies. You know, we supply content to the likes of SNTV and Stats Perform and Reuters from time to time. And then there are more, you know, well-known digital publishers like The Sun Online, Reach and others. And then there are some more sort of niche things like JD Sports and Lad Bible and so on. So, you know, we've got quite a diverse sort of offering. And having that distribution chain gives a brand potentially a huge audience, you know, that we can reach. And because we're trusted and known as a bona fide news organization, then anything that comes from us and drops on the desk of a publisher is accepted as got news value. You know, we don't sort of just, it's not like PR fluff that you know, I get bombarded with stuff, which is like, well, really, you know, there's no news value in this sort of thing. Mm. We're always trying to put a news hook in anything like that we do.
Yeah. What's, you know, what type of stories are successful for you guys now in the digital media era? Because it's a different thing from print. It's a different thing from telly. The formats are different. The speed of the news cycle is very different. The places that things get picked up is different as well. And all of those publishers that you mentioned are going to have a whole range of audiences and things that those audiences actually want from the same kind of manager or from the same player or the same figure around a football match. So, you know, you talk about that news hook. Are there any kind of core ingredients to a good Hater story still that have that sort of same lineage as the stuff in other formats? How's all that shaken out?
Well, the interesting thing is when we started to take, let's say, YouTube more seriously, and we had the long form, and you might get a 12-minute press conference where there's, you know, the sort of peaks and troughs of interest of interesting stuff in there. When you'd go to the agencies, you know, that would help you sort of try and drive it, they'd say, well, can you get all the funnies? Can you get the viral stuff, the funny stuff? And if we can get one of those a week or one a day, you know, and you say, well, it's not like that. They're unpredictable. You might get one where, I don't know, Arsene Wenger picks up someone's phone on the desk because it's ringing, you know, when it's meant to be recording his press conference. You know, they're once in a blue moon, but you can't create them. You can't force them. But we know they perform well in the short form. What we found is there is an audience for the long form who literally just want to see what Mikel Arteta or Enzo Maresca or Ange Postecoglou, what they have to say. You know, they will watch the full press conference. Not huge numbers watch the whole thing, but there is an audience that want to see the whole thing. And then there's an audience, you know, even just in YouTube, we will cut a 1 minute short from the most striking soundbite of that press conference. And it might be a funny, it might be controversial, or it just might be the news line that, you know, an injury or a transfer or whatever it is. And that's obviously the stuff that works best across short form. We need to know that people are going to be flicking through and they stop and look and say, oh, this is interesting, and we'll share it. You know, I've got son, you know, I've got three kids in their 20s, and I know how they consume media. You know, they're flicking through, and then they see one and think that's funny. And it might be a cat video, it might be a Tottenham transfer story or whatever, but, you know, they might ping it to me, sort of thing. You know, they think it's, even I'll watch that. So, you know, we understand that mindset, and absolutely crucial, and this is something that as I said, a major media organisation, I could name them, came to me at the World Cup in Qatar and said, "Jerry, your stuff's flying. You know, we're on absolutely on ground floor level. What can we do?" And I went in and just gave them a few pointers, and they took up three or four of those bits of advice. The one bit they didn't take up was start using our content, so we didn't get that deal back. But one of the key things was to get young people working on those young people, you know, digital natives. Have 23-year-olds doing TikTok, Snapchat, Instagram, and so on. You know, because blimey, at my age, I'm not. You know, I see them, but I don't live in that medium. I'm still old school. But you know, the good young people we've got really understand what people want to see in that world, you know. So that's important as well, is to understand the mindset. And it is, you know, much as you might argue this debate about whether young people have the attention span or not, if the content's good enough, they will get engaged in it. You know, whether it's long form, whether it's 16:9 or upright, if it's good enough and interesting enough, they will get engaged in it. And what's interesting is our YouTube audience. I mean, I spend a lot of time looking at the analytics because you have to understand who the audience is. And it is all over the world. I mean, it's absolutely global. We've got, you know, our analytics tell us we got viewers in North Korea. And, the age range is interesting. You know, we've got as many people over 35 as under on YouTube, on long form. You know, wouldn't that be obviously massively different on the short form platforms? And also, you know, we're still writing for newspapers. We're writing, you know, I still write for broadsheet newspapers. We know that audience is largely, you know, closer to my age than my son's age, you know. So, you know, you're always conscious of, certainly when you're at a press conference, for example, if I'm there either filming or helping the cameraman doing a press conference, I'm sort of thinking, well, this is the headline for the long form piece, but also this is the soundbite that's going to go viral because it's a little funny, and it might just be a little exchange between the manager and the media as he walks in and sits down, which isn't relevant to the press conference, but it's a funny little exchange, and that, you know, again, our guys will pick up on that and go, That's our little sort of short or our Instagram post, because it's funny, people will like it, and it will get moved on. Very occasionally, I mean, most of the time, and we're also sensitive to what the clubs and the players and the managers are like. You know, we don't want to take the mickey out of them. But most of the time, we'll sort of, you know, we won't do anything that's mocking. We did get asked once when I think Erik ten Hag tried to pour a glass of water at the start of his press conference and poured it all over the microphone. Something like, you know, it's a silly little thing, but I very quickly had a response from the press officer saying, "Please, can you not use this?" And I said, "No, we'll cut that." And he was very grateful. He said, "Not everyone would do that. You know, some people would really seize on that." So it's important that you sort of keep that respectful relationship. So, because we are going back time and time again.
Sure.
Some of the YouTubers, some of these sort of Instagrammers, they're sniping from a distance. You know, they're never actually in the room. They don't have a relationship with the clubs. They're not, you know, they're not there. They're just taking a feed. They can post anything they like. And some of them will break embargoes, whether it's deliberate or not, which causes problems. You know, we've had that. But it's so important for us to be in the room, you know, as bona fide journalists, but also to be able to ask the questions. You know, sometimes we will ask a question knowing that's what our audience wants to hear. That's going to drive, you know, that's, I know it's an old rule of journalism, not a rule of journalism, it's an old thing that journalists do. You ask the question to get the response that you know will make a headline. And if everyone's happy to do that and the manager's happy to do that, you're in business, you know.
Yeah.
There was a good example of this. This is where, and I don't want to sound, overinflated about this, but sometimes you just need to sort of guide. We had a young journalist going down to Chelsea women's press conference a couple of years ago when Emma Hayes was still manager, and it was in the week that Joey Barton had really made those inflammatory comments about women's football, which had everyone talking. And by the Friday afternoon, Emma Hayes was doing her pre-match press conference, and again, we're one of the few traditional media that goes to everyone. A lot of them are specialists in women's football. And some of them are from smaller public, you know, more niche publications. But Sky and the BBC were there. And one of our guys was going down. He was a young journalist. And I said, look, you'll probably get a chance to ask one question towards the end. You know, Chelsea are quite good like that. Sky and the BBC always go first. And I said, I'm sure Sky and the BBC will be asking Emma Hayes about Joey Barton and his comments. But if they don't, or, you know, if you want to make sure we get a good follow-up, think of an interesting question in relation to that that you can ask. And bizarrely, but almost predictably, Sky and the BBC didn't ask. No one asked. So this 20-minute press conference went on. No one asked. And then it was the last one was Andrew from Haters. And he said, Emma, I just wanted to get your thoughts on the Joey Barton thing. She said, oh, I'm glad someone asked that because, and then her answer went viral. I mean, it was a fantastic answer. And it was pre-prepared because I know a very good former journalist, really, who works with Emma. And he had sort of prepped her and said, well, you're going to be asked about this and think about your answer. And she'd sort of prepared something quite meaningful. And I saw him. He's an ex-Haters man as well. I saw him a few weeks later and I said, Emma's stuff about, you know, Joey Barton was fantastic. Great answer. And he said, yeah, you know, spoke to her afterwards. And she said, wasn't anyone going to ask me the question? You know, luckily the guy from Haters did. So, you know, it sounds a bit sort of calculating to say, pre-prepare a question when you know what you want the answer to be,
yeah,
because that will drive traffic. But sometimes it works in the favor of the club or the coach or whatever as well. You know, it's get it out there, you know? So,
yeah,
you know, but that's old school journalism. And that, I think that's the important thing from our point of view, is we're working in the digital age and we've got a group of young people who are sort of digital natives as well. But it's really important that me and Nick Callow, my partner at Haters, you know, both schooled at Haters in the old days. And, you know, we've worked for every newspaper in the business, tabloid, broadsheet in between, and for TV and all sorts. You know, we can help them with those old school journalism principles and practices. And sometimes it's about reining in and just guiding them that it's not a good idea to publish this because that's just not good practice. And sometimes it's about helping them to dig out a story, you know. So again, just recently, we had a good, one of our young lads is in touch with a couple of agents, fairly low level, you know, they're sort of nice little sort of non-Premier League transfers, gossip stories or movements.
Yeah.
Which no one else is covering, but we've revamped our website. We can publish directly now and we're on news now and it gets seen. So, you know, one of our biggest stories last week was a transfer involving Bolton Wanderers because no one else bothered to do it. You know, the Nationals aren't going to do that. And while he was in conversation with an agent the other day, the agent said, oh, you might be interested to know. Nothing to do with me, but I've just heard this. Arsenal were looking at Christian Norgaard of Brentford. And this was late on a Friday afternoon. So he said, oh, just had this. What do you think? And I said, well, see if you can ring up Norgaard's agent, see if you can get a comment from him. And that was a bit of a sort of non-denial type thing. He didn't confirm or deny, but he obviously something was going on. So then he said, could we publish this? And I said, well, maybe. But I said, what we're better to, on our side, I said, what we're better to do is what we used to do in the old days, ring up one of our friends who's a national newspaper editor, where they've got their own journalist who's really well connected with, say, Arsenal or Brentford, who can, maybe they can verify it. We get a tip-off fee or whatever. So in fact, the Mirror then picked up, you know, I spoke to the Mirror and, you know, a 30-year-long relationship with the Mirror and their sports editor and correspondents. And they ran it that night. And of course, the transfer happened a day or two later. So that gave all the other young journalists in the office the sort of enthusiasm just to start chatting with agents again. It's something we used to, pre-TV and digital age, this is something that was our bread and butter, was providing those sort of stories for the newspapers.
Yeah.
But pretty much the internet age killed that sort of freelancing. Because once it was out there, it was out there. And it was very hard then to make money as a press, an old school press agency. So that was the origin of us going into sort of broadcast, because you can own the TV pictures, you know, you can own that content.
Yeah.
But now we're sort of bizarrely rolling back into that. And there is a massive interest in if you've got breaking news stories, and they don't have to be about Arsenal all the time. They can be about the Boltons and the Chester
kind of or whatever. The pocket.
Because there are, let's not forget, the audience for clubs outside the Premier League, the number of spectators, what is it, the third, fourth most attended league in the world, the Championship. And there's huge interest around the world in those clubs. You know, there's huge clubs there, but they're underserved. You know, that's been the we've seen that. That's been the way it's been going for 20 years. You know, the day-to-day, the newspapers and a lot of websites aren't really interested in much outside the top, the big six as such. And, let's face it, two of the big six were just above the relegation zone last year. I was in Bilbao for the final, it's a shifting thing, but yeah,
for sure. So one of your team gets the story, eventually it finds its way up the food chain, and
exactly
your old alumnus Mr. Ornstein is able to give it the stamp of approval at the other end.
Exactly. Then I think about 3 days later, David Ornstein, I can reveal Arsenal are and much as I mean, love him to bits, and I've got a lot of time for David. And I think he's, we've had him on the show a few times, and he's worked really hard to build those contacts and to get to the position he's in. There are one or two people in the media who sort of on his coattails a bit. We all call them the tap-in merchants, And even our young guys sometimes say, oh, they'll see it on Twitter and say, oh, such and such has confirmed the story. And I'll say, okay, just have a look on Twitter, X or whatever, and see what, let's say, Sammy Mockbell or Mike McGrath or one of the, newspaper style journalists is, when did they post it? And it will be 3 minutes earlier, 5 minutes earlier. I always insist that it's the old school journalists who generate 90% of the stories that the rest pick up and ping around the world, So much as there is from that sort of younger audience and social media audience, there's a lot of sort of disrespect for the mainstream media. They don't know like we know, especially me, when having been in the business 35 years. They don't probably know the process and how these stories are generated, And overwhelmingly, it's old school journalists who are funded by their publishers, the newspapers or TV organizations, to actually spend time cultivating contacts, digging up stories, verifying them properly, and then publishing. It's not a guy sitting, on a sort of webcam in Italy or Germany, or in their bedroom in Liverpool or whatever, just dreaming up stories and pinging them out there very loudly. They're not necessarily the originators of that story. They sort of amplify it and get all the praise.
Yeah, it is striking that overlap between the older principles, the old school journalism principles, as you talk about, that you guys are training these young staff in. But what have you learned? What have you picked up from some of these younger people? How has your attitude changed? Have you had to kind of keep an open mind about what's going to work, what's going to fly in new media? How's that changed kind of the culture of haters internally?
Yeah, it has, definitely, because I think we always positioned ourselves as a sports news agency, old school media, in the room, in the tent, not peeing in or out or anything. We're in the tent. and then obviously as the sort of digital age grew up and more outlets appeared all over different social media platforms, what became apparent was that there's a huge number of fan-led things, and maybe the most extreme would be the AFTV or Mark Goldbridge, which is pretty sort of shouty, ranty, shock jock style. And we're absolutely insistent all along, we're not going down that road, really not going down that road. But what I've been convinced, especially by the young people and the numbers, is that getting closer to fans, and we can see it in our interaction, we're very engaged with our audience on all social platforms, and that massively helps growth, because not least the algorithm likes to see engagement. but also the positive comments, you know, sometimes negative, but largely the positive comments, then we can see what we're doing right and what we're not doing right. And like I say, you know, this big thing about haters TV's back, you know, which was in the comments yesterday. And, you know, it's almost like, you know, it's lovely to see that people sort of feel like it's like, ah, football is back, haters is back, you know, just because we put up a Mikel Arteta press conference. So we have started to get closer to the fans in terms of doing more sort of stuff with fans around games and fun stuff. You know what? So Aisha, who's doing our women's coverage, she's very good at doing fun, engaging content, picking up on, let's say, I think Sonia Bompester made a comment about loving chocolate. You know, one of the big rewards she got from when they won the league, or won the League Cup, I think, was to have a celebratory sort of bar of chocolate. So then she went round to Chelsea fans before a game saying, what sort of bar of chocolate do you think such and such a player is? You know, or what's Millie Bright as a chocolate bar, or that sort of thing. And then she went to an Arsenal game just after Chloe Kelly had signed for Arsenal, and was asking fans, Chloe Kelly in one word or whatever.
Yeah.
And it was, the enthusiasm was extraordinary. And the demographic was very different. You know, these are teenage girls. These are mostly young women, teenage girls. And there's a different audience there than the sort of blokes you might get at a men's game when you're doing a vox pop. You know, and sometimes you do the vox pops, you try and keep them lightweight. Sometimes you're doing them because there's a protest going on at United. What do they think? Who do they think needs to come in or whatever? You know, you get a different sort of vibe there. But it's interesting to see. And as I say, as we're moving towards more commercial relationships, and we've taken on a commercial sort of director in the last month or two as part of it's a wider group than just haters. We're associated with Boxing News and another couple of channels, or one of our investors has got a wider group. So we've got the shared services of a commercial guy, really, really good, very, very smart operator who's used to dealing with brands. And one of the things he said is, you know, if you want to get a good offering to brands, you need that sort of fun, engaging content, but you also need a really professional look to everything you're doing. You know, we're looking at just rebranding some of the way we present our content, because it's a little bit pickledy at times, because, you know, we don't have a professional designer. You know, we've got a very small team. We got through lockdown with four of us. Up until last year, we're getting by with six or seven people. So, you know, there's a huge amount to do. And sometimes the niceties of uniform design across all platforms and across all content is the last thing on your mind. You're just trying to get the content out there, you know. So we learn a lot and different types of content. And, you know, obviously we're open to ideas, because we will take advice, you know, from people who know the platforms much better than us.
Yeah, sure. I mean, obviously, you know, media has changed a lot in the last 10 years, never mind going back to when, you know, you're sitting next to Peter Drury hearing him wax lyrical about his lunch or whatever prose poems he was ready to try out on you that day. But what do you look at as being kind of the key challenges for the incoming team you've got now and the people who are starting their career in 2025? Because I feel like the biggest thing is, if you go back to the early 90s and the period where you moved into broadsheet journalism, you didn't know what you didn't know, if you see what I mean. Like, the internet was about to revolutionize media and sports media in particular, but you wouldn't really have appreciated it at that point, how much it was going to change. Whereas in 2025, I think we're so used to the idea of disruption that you know things are going to change, but you don't necessarily know what to prepare for. I mean, what do you tell people, or how do you talk to younger members of your team about?
Well, I mean, there's two things. One, it was in-house, obviously, you know, you want to give them as much inspiration and pass on as much experience and ask them for their ideas and what they see, because they will see and understand things in a different way to what I do and what I consume and so on. You know, my starting point for the day is still The Times, the BBC, X to some extent, because I do the social media channels for the Football Writers Association. So I'm monitoring what our members are posting on X and reposting, that sort of stuff. But so, I mean, you know, I've got a pretty good idea of what's going on in the world through that lens. But that's not Instagram, Snapchat, and, loads of TikTok and so on. You know, some apps I don't use really, other than posting a few holiday snaps or something. So I'm relying on them to inform us on that. But also, you're trying to sort of get their understanding of where they see things moving. But also, you know, I'm in the organisation. I'm the one who does go to the big events, the SoccerX and Sports Pros, and talk to people in the business about the you know, the changing trends and where it's going. You know, I spend a lot of time looking at that because we always need to be looking forward. And just as a side issue, it was extraordinary. After lockdown finished, I think the first two conferences, sports business conferences, I went to after that, there was just this outpouring of ideas. I mean, everyone was just so pleased to be back in the room again. But there'd been this acceleration of technology and the way things were consumed and made and created, just in sports media, that had all been sort of sitting there quietly happening for about a year or more.
Yeah.
And when people were finally all able to get back in the room, there was this sort of absolute cacophony of sort of noise about it, because everyone wanted to tell each other about what they were up to and what things were going on and where they were going. You know, we'd all moved massively in that period. Although it seemed like a sort of hiatus, if you like. At the same time, it was this massive sort of engine for accelerating growth in the way media was done. So I'm the one who tends to sort of try and keep on top of all this, but I want to get their feedback. So I'm trying to encourage them to come up with ideas and based on their experiences and obviously feedback what comes in. And then we're trying, you know, with our experiences, you know, as I said before, you're trying to sort of impress on them good journalism practice that we think we'll get results, and that's still valid. And that's all about having good relationships with people in the game and everything else. Then secondly, in terms of outside, I used to go to colleges and schools sometimes and lecture about sports journalism, career in sports journalism. And we've always had really good work experience programs. You know, we had one with the University of Brighton for years, you know, on a rolling fortnightly basis. And we recruited from them. And as I say, people will, you know, for years on end, people will write to Henry Winter to say, I want to be a football journalist. What do I do? And he said, go and see my mate Jerry at Haters. You know, and that's often, that still goes on. But I pretty much stopped. I found it too disheartening to go into colleges and sort of try to tell people what a great career there was to be had in sports media, because I think there is a great career, but there aren't many of them.
Mm.
And probably I can't speak for what a lot of recruiters are looking for. There are a lot of jobs which are in sports media, but they might be working with the clubs, working directly with bigger organisations where they're pretty much, you know, they're desk bound. They're not allowed out. You know, it's not what I'd want to do and would encourage anyone to do. It's almost like factory farming, you know. And you know, you don't. Listen, in the end, I just felt a bit sort of despondent about the future of sports journalism. I certainly discourage any of my kids from getting involved in it. And, you know, they've all got decent sort of careers outside. So it's hard. It's tough. You know, I think for anyone starting out in this business, they've got to be really determined and quite realistic about what the opportunities are, you know.
Yeah, and kind of more, I guess, more able to be malleable and opportunistic and all that kind of thing, because it isn't going to be the same career path that it was when there was that sort of thriving news desk and sports desk culture, yeah. I guess. When you're talking to, maybe that's a part of it, but when you're talking to some of the colleagues that you had in that period when you were coming up, and when you, let's say, you know, back in February, you're at the 70th anniversary celebration, what were some of the things that you found yourself talking about most in terms of that change in the sports industry, in the sports media?
Well, I mean, it was pretty much a Haters thing, what it was like at Haters back in the day. You know, we were in Fleet Street and it was a lot of young people in the room, very ambitious, you know, all quite happy to climb on over each other to get to it when a job came up, you know. I mean, Des Kelly was there, for example. You know, loved Des to bits, but blimey, competitive man. You know, there were a lot of stories, the fun, you know, and I think what was really valuable was you had some of the old school telling, you know, some of the old school guys telling stories about the ludicrous things they did, you know, not terrible things, but just the long-winded ways or the the arcane working methods. And for some of our young people to be in the room listening to some of these stories about, you know, doing 16-hour shifts and traveling all by train, boat, plane, crossing a lake to in Switzerland to get to a story or something. They were just fascinated because, you know, they realized it's not about, you know, doing a 9-to-5 and being on the internet and hoping something drops. You know, you've got to be proactive and go out there. And there's a lot of fun. You know, there certainly was a lot of fun to be had. And of course, in those days, you could get so much closer to the players. You know, you go on pre-season tours, for example, and you'd just be knocking around with players and you'd end up having good relationships and good friendships with players, which, you know, survive to this day, you know. But it's very hard for them to do that now. And I think they, you know, the younger generation all realize they missed the boat there. So there's that. But then there's also, I mean, blimey, you know, some of the old school, I remember the talk, they, you know, we felt we missed the boat because the generation before us, do you remember the famous John Barnes goal in the Maracanã Stadium?
I don't remember it, but I'm aware of
it. No. The three guys who went out there covering for the Sun, Star and Mirror, they went on Concorde. They stayed in 5-star hotels on the Copacabana beach and they had to file 3 stories in a week. You know, it was no mobile phones. No, I mean, I think it was a fax or a teleprinter or whatever. You know, it was a different era, completely different era. But they would also be out socializing with the team, you know, Bobby Robson and all of this, you know. So that was like a ridiculous bygone era. We were sort of coming out of that a little bit. The you know, those sort of all expense paid things weren't happening so much. But we certainly were still closer to the players and you had a better understanding. So that's a difficult thing to see. But I think still the principles are still the same. You know, be build up your contacts and be trustworthy. Because, you know, you can lose your reputation very quickly if you're not.
Yeah.
Play the long game. Be prepared for setbacks. Be persistent. Come up with ideas. You know, be creative. And always look forward. You know, always look ahead and look, what can we do next? You know, think on your feet. So, and these are the sort of people we want to encourage and take on. Because, and then if all goes well, they'll have really good careers because that's a good grounding for them.
Yeah. What is it that keeps you interested in sports media at this point in your career?
Well, it's first and foremost, the sport. I mean, I just love it. You know, I just love sport. And I mean, primarily covering football now, but I used to look a lot of cricket in the past. But I mean, in my early days at Haters, I did Henley rowing once, not having a clue what was going on, but standing on a duck board in the middle of the Thames in a suit, just trying not to fall in. Croquet. I did the World Croquet Championships once.
Wow.
Where the world champion was a sort of tubby 25-year-old student. And when I asked him if croquet could ever take off the way snooker had, for example, he went, "Oh God, no, I don't even watch it," you know. So that was eye opening. And you know, but cricket I love, but we'd love to get cricket coverage back up and running, and that is a long term ambition of ours. Because Haters has a fantastic name in cricket. You know, the PCA Player of the Year tournament was, I think, still called the Reg Hayter Trophy, you know. And Reg Hayter's name, our founder, Reg, you know, his name's up on a plaque in the press box at Lord's. Haters has got a very good name in cricket. So, you know, it'd be nice to get that up and running again because I love spending my time. Yeah, you know, my off time is at cricket if I can.
Yeah.
But football obviously is a passion and a job, you know. So I maybe shouldn't say this, but I went to the Europa League final, media accredited, but also as a fan. So I managed to get a ticket. And having been at the Champions League final as a journalist, you know, and obviously when you are a journalist, you are totally objective and impartial. But it was pretty hard work after Spurs had lost to Liverpool to be sitting there trying to file your final bit of copy as the sort of third or fourth rendition of You'll Never Walk Alone's ringing around the stadium and the players are coming, Liverpool players are coming through with the trophy and the Spurs players are looking glum and you've got to try and get some interviews. And it was a joyless experience for me. And I thought, if Spurs get to a final, a big final, I'm going to go as a fan this time. So I did that this time and I was glad I did. I still managed to sort of combine going and doing some media duties afterwards. And we had a guy, luckily, in Madrid who was doing a lot of the heavy lifting. But I was able to sort of go and do some press conference stuff and mix own interviews. But
Yeah.
primarily, I was just able to stand there for an hour and a half and just, let rip as a fan, which I hadn't done for a while. And that was good fun. Yeah, that was a great experience. I've been at
Yeah.
all three of Tottenham's UEFA Cup / Europa League wins. I was there as a schoolboy in 1972. My dad took me out of school for the day. And then in 84, when they won the famous one on penalties, Tony Parks saving two penalties in the shootout, I was there as a
Yeah.
sort of young fan, on the terraces with my mates. And then this time round, I was there. And in fact, that phone call that just now was Julie Welsh, who's doing the history of Tottenham. She's, the first female football reporter way back in the 60s, 70s. She does the official history of Tottenham, and she wants to get my update on the Europa League final. So I'm going to speak to
Wow.
her in a bit. Yeah.
That's some record. It reminds me of my dad's unfortunate record is he's been to three Arsenal League Cup defeats, including Swindon and Birmingham City, which I don't think anybody
Whoa.
saw coming in either case.
Yeah.
Do you thanks, it's been great chatting to you. I think you've been very generous with your time, but we should probably look to wrap it up. I mean, there are three questions that we've been asking every guest on Outlines so
Oh,
far.
yeah.
The first is do you have an origin story or something that sparked your interest in sport?
Well, I mean, it's probably the same as a lot of people, but the first time I went to a football match, which, bearing in mind, was 1968, and all I'd seen was a bit of Match of the Day in black and white on a small, very small screen. The first time it was Chelsea against Spurs at Stamford Bridge. My dad took me there. He was a long-standing Spurs fan. I'd grown up in Highbury, almost opposite the Arsenal ground, with a lot of my mum's side were all Arsenal, but Spurs were the team back then in the 60s. And I went to this game, and it was just like everything. It was the colour, the smell, the noise, the atmosphere. It's just fantastic. I was, hook, line, and sinker. That was it. Me. They lost that one, and then I think shortly afterwards, they played Man City at home, and they lost heavily. But didn't put me on.
Yeah.
And yeah, absolutely. Just being there, the colour, the spectacle as a young kid. I vaguely remember 2 years earlier playing on the stairs with my sister and hearing my dad shouting at the telly, not realizing it was the World Cup final. So although the World Cup final in 66 was in my lifetime, it was going on in another room and I could hear my dad shouting. But no interest in it at that point. So that something,
Yeah.
I guess we started playing football at school at seven, something like that, so that was the point at which I really got into it. And on a similar basis with cricket, again, you're watching cricket on a black and white screen back then. It's very sort of rudimentary. And then one day, I think school holidays, I went to see England West Indies at the Oval with a mate from school, and it was Gary Sobers batting off. It's like Clive Lloyd, Kalacharan, Gary Sobers. I mean, wow, absolutely
Yeah.
nothing ever beat that. So I'm totally hooked on those two sports ever since. Nothing can sort of, once you're exposed to that, and one of my sons, I took him to a test match at North at Edgbaston, and got a couple of tickets late one Sunday in 2009 for the Ashes. And it was in the Eric Colley's stand, so it's quite lively, a lot of banter, fancy dress, singing, and so on. I think Ricky Ponting was booed as he came out to bat. Freddie Flintoff made a quick fire 80. And my son, who was 10, I think, at the time, was just absolutely hooked. That was, you could
Yeah.
just see his world opened up, and he's a massive cricket fan now. So, you can't beat that first experience of going to the game and seeing it in colour. Although we
Yeah,
still have,
sure.
especially coming from the black and white age.
But it is interesting. I mean, given how your perspective on news gathering and all the rest of it, that it was being in the space and
Yeah.
being up close to it and around the texture of it that really hooked you. What's your favorite piece of sports storytelling?
Well, Yeah, I thought about this because, I mean, obviously, blimey, I grew up reading the newspapers. You know, I'd read the back pages. I'd read newspapers back to front, still do, sort of when I have a physical one, paper. And, you know, I used to keep scrapbooks and all this sort of stuff. But in terms of something that I've really, really enjoyed watching, and I think it's just almost a perfect bit of storytelling for this age, was when Sky did a documentary piece called Through Your Eyes, and it was the retelling of the 2019 World Cup, England Cricket World Cup win through the players' voices.
Yeah.
And I've watched it about five times and just love it. You know, it's just, they're great character. You know, Mark Wood is a fantastic character. And, you know, fascinating. Joe Root, arguably our greatest ever batter. And just listening to their stories, and that was such a dramatic day. I wasn't there. I was watching at home. And actually, you know, I really enjoyed sitting at home with my kids watching that sort of thing. So that was, I think that's been a fantastic, I recommend it to everyone. And alongside that, I know it's a completely different era, but Fire in Babylon, which was the tale of the West Indies coming through the 70s and the political context to it. You know, I lived in Brixton during the riot era, the first riots in 82. I lived in Brixton and it was quite an eye-opening experience. But, you know, I used to go into the pubs and watch the cricket there, you know, and the old West Indian guys would be talking about Michael Holding, Whispering Death, you know. And years later, I got to meet Michael Holding. You know, I've interviewed him over the years. He even gave one of my sons a little masterclass in the nets at Lord's at one event, you know. And what a fantastic man. But I wouldn't like to have been Brian Close when he was being peppered with, I mean, that was brutal, you know. But that, again, is another fabulous film. So those two, cricket actually, are the two stories that I've seen, that I love seeing, yeah.
Yeah. And what's finally, what's a sports story you'd like to tell or see somebody else tell?
Oh, well, I'd love to tell England's World Cup victory next year. You know, that would be, see Harry Kane lifting that trophy would be absolutely, you know, that would be the ultimate, and to be there and report on it. And as I said, my first World Cup was 94, and it was interesting because, you know, I was in Dallas on the opening day. It was not the opening game, but the opening day there was a match in Dallas. And honestly, it was a bit like you hear stories from the Club World Cup. The scalpers, the touts were trying to give away tickets for a dollar. You know, I mean, it was there was no interest in football in America. And I think after about a week, you could only see it on ESPN Latino channels. You couldn't see it on mainstream. And it was a great, great World Cup. Bulgaria went so close and so on. I went all the way to the final, probably the worst final ever. But I went all the way there from day one through to the final, and it was just a fantastic journey. And I got probably my biggest scoop in journalism. I was there the day Maradona was kicked out for drugs, and you know, and there were only a handful of British media in Dallas that day, so I was filing for about five different papers, you know, middle of the night against deadline. And to have, you know, the world's greatest footballer kicked out of the world's biggest sports event for taking drugs is that's not a story you're going to get ever again, really.
No.
And I think coming back, when I was finally coming back from the stadium, I stopped by I don't think I had mobile phones even then. I stopped by a payphone to call my wife, which was like 3 o'clock in the morning here. And I said, you won't believe it. I've just, you know, had this massive scoop, the biggest story that's going to happen in my career, I reckon. Maradona kicked out the World Cup, drugs, you know, no. And she said, what, you rang me at 3 a.m. to tell me that, you know, put the phone down. It put me back in my box, you know. But so to go through, and actually, just I'm blabbering on here. The other big exclusive I got there was after the Escobar. Remember, Andres Escobar was shot.
Mm.
I was doing primarily. I was accredited via the Sunday Telegraph with Colin Gibson, the sports editor, and I was staying in a little condominium without a phone. But I'd just make a call. It was a bunch of friends, you know, lived there. I'd make a call in every morning, say, what shall I, you know, what do you want me to do? And Colin said, well, look, there's been this guy shot dead. Can you, FIFA's headquarters is in Dallas, the Four Seasons. Can you get in and get a comment from Sepp Blatter, General Secretary of FIFA? So I drove up to the Four Seasons, and I just sort of, you know, went to the desk and said, I need to see Sepp Blatter, showed him my badge, blah-de-blah, and no, that's impossible. And then eventually, just with persistence and politeness, and after about an hour of just badgering, I sort of got further and further towards the inner sanctum, if you like. and different layers of officialdom towards it. And finally was shown into this room where Sepp Blatter was sitting in a huge room with a desk. He didn't have a small white cat on his lap sort of thing, but he sort of said, "Oh, Mr. Cox, I've been expecting you," you know. Went on to say how much, as a former journalist, he respected the Telegraph and the fact that I'd asked politely. And he said, "But this match is about to kick off." I think it was Belgium, Switzerland, something like that. Would you mind? I can give you my full attention at halftime. If you want to join me, we'll have a cup of tea and sandwiches. And we had a cup of tea and sandwiches, watched the game. Then at halftime, he said, "Right, he gave me a nice sort of comment on it. It's a tragedy for the family. Football's a family. It's a tragedy. We feel it like one of our sons, blah, blah, blah." So I filed it to the Telegraph, world exclusive, you know, Blatter says this. And when I got back, you know, Colin Gibson said, "Oh, we're having a staff meeting at the Telegraph, a kickoff meeting for the start of the year. We'd love to get you on board as a regular," which I did then for many years as a regular correspondent for the Telegraph. And he said, "Obviously, you had that great scoop at the World Cup." And I'm thinking, yeah, Maradona, you know. He goes, no, Blatter. You know, so what I thought was the big scoop was not quite the one he thought. So to square the circle, to go there next year and get the story I've always wanted to report on, which is England winning the World Cup, would having totally ignored it when I was 6 years old, would be fantastic. So that would be my dream story this time next year.
That would be something. And I think that will be a tournament that is rich in stories for a whole lot of reasons, but that's all to come. Jerry, it's been a real pleasure, and thanks again for giving us so much of your time.
Thank you, Owen. It's good to see what you're doing, and good luck with it.
Cheers. Outlines is an original production from 2640.